Hey, it's Tobias here. If you want to learn a little bit about my firm or see my portfolio, head on over to acquirersfunds.com.
I'm not going sober. We are screaming.
That's this meeting is being live streamed.
Yeah, I'm not. No, I don't want that. I legit think that pot helps me as a husband and a father. So I don't understand the point in dropping that for me, but booze, I understand the point of dropping. Welcome to Value After Hours.
Hey. And we're live.
I am one of the hosts, Bill Brewster, with my esteemed colleagues, Tobias Carlisle and Jake Taylor.
I missed you guys.
Thank you to the 10. It's been a while. We're sorry that we took a break.
It was good. It's completely disconnected. Didn't check Twitter once.
Bro, I spent some of my break listening to Ray Dalio, and I'm pretty convinced the U.S. is fucked.
Oh, man. Already? We're getting into that.
Yeah, I'm there. I'm all in on, short the U.S.
Well, let's save that for a topic, but I want to – let's unpack that one.
Happy New Year.
Yeah. Toby, what's other than the imminent demise of the Great Republic, what do you have for today?
I'm just blanking on it. I sent you guys my little link yesterday.
Values Day in the Sun, the Widowmaker trade.
The Widowmaker.
cheap stocks to finally have their day in 2022. I think that article's been written every year since 2016. Yeah. that was one where they describe it as the Widowmaker trade. So I just want, that's the only thing I want to talk about.
Oh my God.
What do you got, JT?
I have a piece prepared that's a little tribute to E.O. Wilson, who passed away over our break. And it's just a really cool guy. And I want to highlight some of the stuff that he shared with the world.
That sounds good.
You want me to go first?
Yeah, let's jump into why we're doomed.
And yeah, let's get through that first.
Out of the hole.
I like it. I like it. I guess, you know, so first of all, he was on with William Green on We Study Billionaires. Good signing for Preston Pysh and Stig Broderson, by the way.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Selfishly happy because it adds the podcast back to my listening repertoire, at least for a while.
Well, what about the mastermind updates with
I did 2.25 now.
Yeah.
I pop in occasionally.
Oh, okay.
But the other thing is, he was on with Lex Fridman and it was quite good. And I think he had that answer on China. I can't recall what it is, but, the perception of the answer was not exactly great.
I, for one, welcome out new overlords. Is that what he said?
Oh, I don't know. But like I
that involved hot dogs. Was there no hot dog in there?
I guess what I would say is, like, I do sort of think that these two interviews are probably worth listening to. He's going over the same thing a lot. And I sort of wonder why he's doing it, but I don't know how he handicaps things, but he's put like, I'm bound to mess this up. Sorry to our Bridgewater fan. Holler at me sometime, by the way. Like, I think he's got like the probability of a civil war in the U.S. approaching a third and the probability of armed conflict with China approaching a third. That's what, like, I was saying. I was like, you play the simulation three times and we go to war once. That seems a bit high.
Robert McKay says Dalio is kind of deterministic. No,
I don't think so. I think he's very probabilistic.
See, I think he's deterministic. That's good. Let's talk about that in a little bit. We'll come back to that.
Okay.
I don't want to interrupt you. I don't want to derail you. Keep going.
I mean, I don't know how to summarize it.
What's the other third? We just muddle through.
Yeah. Well, I just think that, like, fundamentally, like, if you look at our politics, they're super, super polarized. We're spending a ton of time fighting amongst ourselves. I think that it's hard to argue that the society is as hungry as some of the emerging countries. We're definitely spending more than we're making. And, like, you know, that doesn't feel great to me. So, I would say, check out what he says and listen to him more than my summary of him, but,
stock prices, bro. I'm just kidding.
Well, but the, I mean, that's, but that's part of, that's like dollar debasement. I mean, maybe not relative to other currencies, right? But I mean, this is what Preston was talking about a while ago when he said, like, versus M2 or whatever, you're only up 6% in a decade or whatever. I don't know. Not impossible for me to buy into the theory.
So the war part was the main takeaway, the biggest thesis part?
I think where we rank on education of the middle of our country, like primary education. No, we still have a monopoly on great universities, and that's a good thing. But, I think the fighting amongst ourselves, the not producing nearly as much as we're buying, and the undereducation of most people, I viscerally agree with those. I haven't put data to it. It's just not very uplifting.
Gents, we got a 25-pound shout out from Colin Moore. Thanks, brother. I saw the icon and I knew who it was.
That is what is up.
That's a lot.
Here's my problem. The Berkshire AGM Guinness Fund. Good. Excellent.
Nice.
Yeah. We'll make sure we get you one of those there.
I may just bring you an edible. I may not go back to booze. Fair warning.
I'm going to be there this year. JT's going to be there. Are you coming, Bill? Are you doing Berkshire?
Oh, yeah.
All right, good. We're on.
Miss Berkshire. Hell no.
Is it going to be on? Omicron's not going to derail us.
I sure hope so. I mean, Daily Journal is remote. I saw. Oh,
that's a bummer.
I know.
How far away is Daily Journal?
February.
Okay.
Mid-February.
3 months.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Maybe summer will be looking a little bit better.
Yeah.
Let's get back to Dalio. I think that Dalio markets himself as being probabilistic, and he has all of these, you know, radical honesty, the transparency and all that stuff. And then I read his stuff and I always think this is so deterministic, like including that article, like why the economy is a beautiful machine. It's just the wrong analogy. And then you think about like what macro is often, doesn't have to be this way, but to get the convexity in the trades, you need to get a number of things that occur in sequence, right? And that's the way that the macro guys often think about this stuff. And so Dalio's a macro guy and he thinks about these machines that have all of this stuff occurs in sequence and you get this output at the end. And I just fundamentally disagree that that's how anything works. It's way too unpredictable. To say that there's a 1/3 chance of a civil war in the States is bonkers.
Yeah. Yeah. So I may have miscited that, but I don't think I did. I think he actually said that. And two, I do think there's some marketing speak when you're assigning probabilities. Like I would be interested to see the card on his chest or whatever that he wears around Bridgewater that talks about his strengths and weaknesses. I would not be shocked if one of the weaknesses is in public. Sometimes you are a little bit hyperbolic on your probabilities.
I mean, I get it. You got to like to get a tent, like as a marketing tool, it's pretty good. Here we are talking about it. I don't know if I want my portfolio manager talking like that, though.
Well, it matters what he does, not what he says. I'm not trying to say he's doing stuff and saying different things. I don't want that to come across. I know I just said it, but I'm not trying to say it. I don't know how much is like that's a true assignment of probabilities and how much of that is I'm speaking to the common person via a podcast. And in order to wake them up, I'm going to say this probability.
I still think it means you're dismissed by a lot of other people who are just like, that's just ridiculous. 1/3. Like even saying 1 in 10 would be extreme. Like the US has had a civil war. It was a long time ago under an entirely different system. And civil wars aren't that, like if you go back and read any ancient history, like civil wars happen all the time in every little town all the time. But they don't happen at, you know, peak prosperity. And I realize that that's not evenly distributed, but I think that people have got a lot of money at the moment. Maybe drain away some of that money in it.
Did he put a timeline on that? Because like that's another that radically changes your probabilities.
This year, wasn't it? 2022.
No, I thought he said in the next decade.
Okay.
All right, yeah. That does change the calculation a little bit. But I still don't think so. I still think that's way too high.
I I tend to agree with you.
I also don't know what the definition of a civil war is, right? This is, you start to get into what's the definition of is.
Calling each other names on Twitter.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
I've been fighting a war for a long time. I'm
I think
a vet of the
broadly
wars.
Speaking, the message that he's saying is maybe worth listening to and thinking about a little bit.
Josh Stonko says that it's not a 1/3 chance, it's a 40% chance.
Hmm. Well, that's high. I don't know.
That's
I haven't
even
done
more
the
ridiculous
analysis myself.
Seems to like come that, up with that level of specificity.
Seems like it deviates from the base rate.
There are a lot of other things that are much more impactful to society that are much more likely to occur than a civil war. Like just a big stock market crash has got to be a reasonable possibility at some point, just because of the overvaluation and all of the other, you know, now that we've seen. I still think that the fact that the tech wreck is occurring under the covers, and I don't know how it is not impacting the indexes, but evidently, you know, the fang or whatever makes up the top of the index, like there's still pretty big, good companies growing pretty quickly. They're the bulk of the index. So that means an index crashes.
25%-ish at this point.
25%.
Top five.
It's crazy how big they are compared to everything else. It's just hard to kind of wrap your head around unless you go, like Apple's a $3 trillion company. There are plenty of companies in there that, you know, drops down pretty rapidly once you get outside those top five.
Yeah.
Wow, Twitter's off 5% today. What's Pinterest down?
Beefy Capital says the base rate in the 10%? US is 0.46% of the time. Is that for a civil war, Beefy?
24% of the time?
0.46%
wow.
of the time.
Oh. Guys, tech is getting wrecked today. Did you guys know this?
Yeah, I saw ARK was down quite a bit. That's one topic we need to talk about a little bit too.
That is wild.
It had a little rally yesterday. You see, Tesla was up more than 10% yesterday. 10% on a $1 trillion company.
Well, it used to matter.
That's $100 billion. Like that's an airline market cap.
That might be the whole airline industry market cap at this point.
The other thing was that Toyota has now surpassed GM in terms of, I think it was number of cars sold in the States as the biggest automaker. And Ford had the best performed stock price of all the automakers last year.
Yeah, shout out to Bluth Capital on that. He was early on that. I was doing some work on Expel, and I misframed. They make like the wrap they call a clear bra for the cars, and I misframed what I really think about it because I said like, why isn't it massively cyclical? That's not really what I think. I guess what I really think is like deep into a run where the wealthy have gotten wealthier, wrapping their cars for $10,000 seems like maybe they would do it.
Is it $10,000 to wrap your car?
Well, here, now the Expel people are going to be like, that's not what it is. I think it's like 6 to 8 to wrap a full car. I think you can get like a little strip for a couple hundred on your bumper. I don't know why anyone would do that. I think it's like $2,000 to do the front of your car. But like, I don't know, man. You gotta like A, really value your car, or B, drive a really expensive car before like the percentages seem to make sense to me.
What is
there? There's a roller up here that's wrapped in like this black, purple, three-dimensional color. Looks amazing with these like orange rims. I don't know who drives it. I've never seen him. I've just seen the car park.
A what?
It's a roller. It's like a Rolls Royce.
Oh,
a wrapped
nice.
Rolls Royce. It's like black, but like when the sun hits it, it's like a purple kind of three-dimensional color to it with these orange.
They got some dope
decals.
Shit, man.
Dude, it's a cool looking. It's a very, very cool looking car. I just bought some Expel. I think it looks cheapish.
I know that's not true.
That is true. I bought some Expel.
You bought Expel?
Yeah.
Good for you. There you have it. That's not. I didn't think it would screen cheap. Yeah.
I've never even heard of it.
Expel?
No.
Oh, it's a massive.
Really? Are you messing around? All the microcap guys have been all over that for about 5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's come off a bit from its peak, though. It's worth having.
It's pretty cool how you can turn your car matte with a wrap, too. I like that. It's cheaper than painting.
Can you peel that off at the end and hand back in a brand new car?
Well, yeah, I think you can. I mean, now, I don't know. I mean, if you watch the videos on the internet, it's pretty impressive what you can do to that stuff before you actually damage the car. Now, I don't think, like, some guy will jab a key into a car.
And you throw a sledgehammer at the window?
Well, you can dent the underline. Right? Like, it won't strengthen your metal.
Right.
But you can key it, and it protects your paint. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I'm sure that those cars get keyed a lot.
Well, if you're gonna key a car, like a Bentley is what you would key, right? Or one of these matte paint jobs. So I get it. I think I just don't know how to underwrite the growth.
Let's talk about Arc Berkshire, because Arc topped out at $156 in February last year. And it closed out the year like in the 90s, I think. And then I saw today after the, like, it's off another 5% today. So it's like 91 last time I looked or something like that. Like, that's a very, very big drawdown. That's like 35%. Someone want to do the calculation for me. And then you contrast that with Berkshire, on the other hand, which is up 35% a year. Like, the differential in those two moves, if as representative of value versus growth, like that's an extraordinarily big move that makes up for a lot. Like, that, I don't know what the difference is. It's like 70%, something like that, over the course of a year. That washes away a lot of sins. Like, you got to outperform by a lot for many, many years to catch up 70%. And then you can do it in 1 year. So I think that's emblematic of what's happening in the market.
Looks pretty good still for Kathy.
It does.
But if you were trying to imagine that there was a regime change, then it might look a little like that.
I saw a good tweet. I just followed the guy, but I'm just blanking on the name a little bit. He said ARK would have owned all 50 of the Nifty 50 in the 70s.
They would have outperformed over the long term. Had to make it.
Did they?
The Nifty 50 did end up outperforming, yes.
From that, is that right?
Yes, it's correct.
Well,
you also had to live through a 90% drawdown, stay committed to the strategy, and end up having the time frame. But yes, if you just look at stats, they were.
How long did it take to get you?
Yeah, when was it measured from?
Break even.
I think it was like 40 years.
Well, that's
to be fair, if you look at the paper that Albert Bridge put out, that's how long value has underperformed. So, or 30. Okay,
I said that just before you did.
Yeah. So, you know, it all depends where you're looking from.
Shout out to Drew, by the way.
I like that paper.
He had a good chart storm.
Did he?
Yeah, he's that JT just shared that there's a. There's a he makes the point that the fundamentals of growth have outperformed value in the US. He compares the US growth and value to European growth and value, and he makes the point that the fundamentals of growth have marginally outperformed value over, I forget the time period, Jake, was it like 10 years?
I think it's the last 10.
And then but the multiple expansion has been massively bigger for growth in the US versus value. And then he looked at the European market because the fundamentals for growth haven't been as strong in Europe, but they have performed. They haven't performed as well as the US growth, but they've got much bigger. There's a much bigger premium for growth in Europe than there is in the US. So the most expensive stuff in the world is European growth, and the cheapest stuff in the world is European value.
Interesting. So it's kind of a 99, even more so. For the US in Europe right now.
Right. Value Stock Geek says Jeremy Siegel did a study. I guess it's the Nifty 50 outperformed, but you had to hold for 25 years.
Yeah. And I think he did that in like 98 or so. So, you know, you go peak to peak and whatnot, but it did end up outperforming.
Let me do my topic.
Yeah.
There's nothing particularly stunning about this article. They've gone and interviewed a whole lot of fund managers and said, what do you think is going to work next year? And everybody's picked what sort of everybody's picked value, 23% value, 13% green, 11% small caps, 10% growth, 9.4% EM, US tech, 6.6%, other 25.5%.
What's in that other?
I don't know. Is that equities? I guess it was equities.
Yeah.
Andrew Ang, head of factor investing at BlackRock, says you want to hold value in the long term because we'll go back to normalcy. That's basically my view too. But the real reason that I wanted to share this is there's this widowmaker chart. I'll just this is high technology. I'm just going to hold it up.
Oh, the, Jesus,
does that work?
No. Yes. Now we see it.
You get the idea. Basically, growth massively outperformed. But the really funny part is the name of that chart. They call it the widowmaker. Global value shares fell to a record low versus growth peers in November. Move that over, is a widowmaker trade now.
Move over short JGBs. We've got a new widowmaker in town.
I thought it was like, I thought Nat Gas was the widowmaker.
Do you want to be part of the widowmaker? Is that like a good contra or is that not
you
good?
Make your wife a widow.
Oh, okay.
Not to mention, I mean, you know, I don't know what, like, I'm looking through this this Albert Bridge thing. I mean, I don't know. It has just been a shitty 30 years for value.
Yeah. Had a brief moment in between, like 2002 to 2007, but it's been pretty gnarly. It's been a one-way street.
Yeah.
What's 30 years run us back to, like, the early 1990s, I guess? 1992 or something.
Yeah, that's how the math works.
Math checks out there.
That is how the math works.
Well, when you go over to 99-2000, it gets harder to do the math. Like I'm trying to do math with my kids. It's got to learn these things.
Can't be done once you...
I mean, talk about reasons to stay in the market. Since 1980, the market has been up for the year 83% of the time.
Yeah, that's wild, isn't it?
Was that that's since 80? That's from Drew's...
Yeah. Since 2003, it's even more impressive. Only two down years with an average return of 11.8% for the Dow and 12.8% for the S&P.
He's got a good
comment. That's what Ken Fisher always says. Ken Fisher's like, if you're going to get out of the market, you have to bet on down big. And the probability that you're right is like so low that it just doesn't make any sense. Because even down small doesn't really matter.
Even down big, like here's the problem with getting it right down big. Is that you have to get back in.
Yeah.
And it's just bloody impossible. And if you go and look at any, like, you don't know, like, whether it's a 2009 scenario or a March 2020 scenario.
Second leg down.
Or 1929. Like, you just have no idea what the scenario is because it's all, you know, the overvaluation on the upside is irrational. And it's entirely possible you see undervaluation on the other side that's completely irrational too. You know, there's that. I always attribute it to David Einhorn, but I don't know who it is. But it's like what do you call a stock that's down 80% that proceeds to go down 90%? You know, that's for the person who invests down 80%, they lose half of their net worth riding it down from 80 to 90. So it's just the reverse compounding is so brutal that it's just so hard to time it each way. You're better off just expecting a 50% haircut like once a decade and just gritting your teeth through it.
Yeah. Well, and this I mean, you know, for US growth, so the Russell value from 2009 to 2021 returned 292%. Russell growth 632. S&P value 298%. S&P growth 602%. So, you can lose 70% in a correction, pretty much break even there. I mean, not exactly. I know that math doesn't check out, but it's wild to see it in numbers. I like what Drew did. Thank you, Drew, for doing this. So I just don't know if you're going to pick like that. This is the year that value outperforms. Statistically, I think you're going against the tide.
I'd rather pick the Civil War happening.
Yeah. How did value do from 1860 to 1864?
Strong. The tough years for value have been like around tech. So 1825 was a tough one because of the introduction of the steamship and the trains. And then 1841 was the first tech revolution. That was the introduction of the telegraph. And there have been a few others. There were like you know, technology revolutions around cars. That was the great write-up that came out of OSAM a little while ago when they're building up the infrastructure for motor vehicles. It was tough for value because the tech stocks of the day were motor cars. That's just unimaginable for us today. I know.
I mean, this is a little bit of the problem with all of this stuff is like, all right, how many crashes, real crashes do we have to measure? Like a hand, like 10 or something. I don't know. It's probably a little higher than that, but the data set is not anywhere near robust enough to be able to draw much statistical inference. So there'd be dragons still statistically, I think.
It's over 100 years of data.
I know, but the number of crashes in that. So what's the typical crash, right? Like, well, there is no typical when you have a small data set.
It's 100 years. What do you define a long data set as? 1,000 years?
What are we talking, geologic terms?
Yeah, depends, I mean, right? In the history of financial markets, 100 years is like a pretty robust data set.
I saw something that like the length of time for the average currency is like 70 years.
Each year on its own is not that statistically significant. It's, I'm saying like the epochs within financial history have only been a small number of them. So we don't have that much explanatory power.
I guess. Honestly, I think crashes are made up by bears as marketing material. I know people love to talk about them, but like I think it's mostly because of the fear response and how people get clicks rather than reality.
They do come around, like they come around about once every 7 years.
No doubt.
And you know, you get the full.
Then money printer go burr.
Yeah, but what I've generally observed is that for the most part we've, you know, well, this is easy to say because we're at all time highs now, but we've always gone back to. I think that the under, you know, when there's a Jeremy Grantham article that a mate of mine sent through, and I just don't know if it's a recent one or if it's an older one. I didn't look at the date, but he's talking about his sister's pension. Has anybody read that recently?
No,
I think it's called My Sister's Pension, something like that. Well, he's got this. Well, he just says that he's run his sister's pension since 1968, and she's like she's not really interested in the market at all. So he's never like had to explain to her what's in there. So he just has completely free hand in this account, and he contrasts it with his institutional investors who he has to justify what he's doing to them all the time, and they don't like it. They want him to change allocations and things like that. And of course, his sister's account's done very well. He told her once what was in the account, and she was just like, sell it all. So he never did that again. But he makes the point that, you know, the underlying engine of stock market returns is ultimately GDP, or, you know, what companies are earning. And he said that is incredibly stable over time. It's like, basically it's, you know, it moves 1 or 2% in any given year. And then he contrasts that with the moves in stock prices, which can be like 19 to 20% on average in any given year. Well, on average. And so he says, you know, you've got 20 times the movement in.
Yeah. I think I saw it. Like he said 17 times, if I remember that paper right. Like I wrote that down at one point.
Go back and look at it. 19 times. 19% versus 1%.
That the relative movement versus the price movement, like fundamental movement versus price movement,
right? And yeah. What I have observed is that every time that there's a gigantic sell off, like it sucks for that 18 months or the 2 years that you endure it and you feel stupid, and then you completely, you know, that 18th, I always talk about the 18th value or the 18th rally that gets sold. Like that's when you just like, it doesn't matter anymore. I'm going to go be something else. I'm going to do another job. And then that's, of course, when it rallies. But what I have just eyeballed from the charts is that they seem to just sort of, the portfolios run back up to where they would have been absent the crash. And it's like the crash just sort of, it's there, but it's almost like you could just erase it from history for the most part. You know, just rub it out and then just draw a dotted line from one part to the other part. And I guess if you can take that view about it, you do pretty well.
Yeah.
But it's hard to remember that for 18 months. I mean, when I was, you know, marketing portfolios to people just after the 2009 crash. I talked to a lot of people who had, and this is like 2012. I talked to a lot of people who had sold out of the market in 2009, basically at the bottom. Like they'd taken, 2007 was the half year crash that sucked. 2008 was an entire year of just getting punished, including Q4 of 2008 when the market was off like 12 or 14%. And so people just said, this is enough, I'm going to sell out here. And then they didn't get back in. And so the number of times that I talked to people who just missed the entire rally back, the entire bounce, it made me realize that what you've got to do is you've just got to find a way to stay invested. And if that means putting on a hedge, do that. If that means carrying cash, do that. If that means not looking at it, do that. Just whatever you can use to keep yourself in there, and just know that basically it's not your fault. The market sells off 50% every 10 years or so.
Yeah, but Robert Kiyosaki told me that he knows when it's going to happen.
Is that Rich Dad Poor Dad?
Yes. Just getting richer off more marketing.
When's it going to happen?
I don't know. I need to subscribe to his service for 20 grand a year.
I think in my Christmas special last year, I said it was February. So there you go. February.
Bang.
February to August. I'll give that one for free.
I don't know, man. Yeah. I think you hit on a key thing. And like part of why I'm still working through why like this current drawdown's tough on me, but I know for a fact that part of what it was just like, I helped my mom buy a house. I had a couple cars that I bought. It was like a lot of, I'm starting to break ground on this other house. It's like a ton of liquidity going around, and the idea of needing to raise cash at a time when, you know, things are selling off. I mean, that like to me is the biggest sin that you can possibly make. So part of why I like British American Tobacco is I get a reasonably good dividend yield. And what I really fundamentally believe is like cash coming in all the time. I know this is so boomer, but it like gives staying power. So sometimes optimal performance, I think, like running all out and trying to be optimal all the time can actually potentially could have put me in suboptimal outcomes where you're selling at the wrong time. So having cash plus some dividend stocks, even though, you know, maybe it underperforms or whatever, I think over the long term is sort of what I've come up with.
What about the tax efficiency of it? Like if you looked at, you know, just some sort of program where you sold, like what's the, I know you're getting a big dividend yield on British American Tobacco, so it might not, this may not work, but you know, you can sell say 4% of your holdings every year and you get long-term capital gains treatment for that. Yeah. Whereas if you're clipping a big dividend, you're paying a higher rate.
Yeah. I'm sure I have a suboptimal outcome. I have a suboptimal brain.
I mean, you could put it across like whatever portfolio of positions that you like. There's probably an ETF or something that matches that. And then you could just sell off some fixed portion of that quarterly or something like that. And then you're paying tax at a.
Yeah, but I think Bill's hit on an important aspect in that there's kind of the engineering answer. And then there's also sort of the human answer. And what the engineering answer would be optimizing like you're talking about, Toby. But the human answer for him is that continuing his ownership in a way where it's not being diluted by selling lets him stay in that game for longer than he might otherwise. And there's almost like, we've talked before about slack in systems and finding new levels of optimization by having slack. You know, having a little bit of slack in the mathematical part of the optimization might be allowing a psychological maximum to be achieved through, you know, being able to retain his ownership and collect the dividend, even though if it's not as tax efficient.
Yeah. Well, and also I think it's like, do I actually think that I would sell 4% in the middle of a crash and that I would actually only sell 4% in the top, like during a mania? And would I be able to actually know, like, I just don't, you know, the execution of a theoretical answer is the hard part. And I am trying to figure out what I can execute, not what's right.
Can't you automate some of that stuff? Like with, I don't want to say the old Betterment used to, didn't they, like, there was a way that you could automate tax loss selling and a whole lot of other stuff in there. And that might've been one of those things. I'm a big fan of automation. I'm not criticizing the approach, just just in the sense, just I think you can achieve the same ends in a different way, maybe in a more efficient way.
But well, you built your own ETF and I'm an idiot. So that's the difference between the two of us.
Can't talk about that.
Well, that is factually what you did.
Don't let compliance.
You don't have to hide for the fact that you did that, do you? Like, I mean, that's what I'm saying, right? Like, you optimize to a structure.
Listen, you can promise 40% a year, and there's no no issues.
Yeah, so there's some bullish marketing of ETFs out there. I'm always impressed because my compliance would not let me get any of that through.
I mean, you talk about compliance, you're in front of an acquirer's funds thing. It's not as if this is some secret that you have an ETF.
That's the firm.
Okay.
That's the firm name.
What does the firm do, Toby? What would you say you do here?
It's a registered investment advisor.
Okay. All right. My apologies.
You're not allowed to discuss securities. Otherwise, that triggers the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Solicitation.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know.
If you structure the same portfolio as a separately managed account, you can talk about it as much as you want.
All I know is that I am not you, and I am trying to solve for me, and I have a lot of problems. So I'm just trying to work around my problems.
We're all mates. We're working through it. We've got three blue zip-up pullovers, and we're solving those problems.
Preventing civil war.
And I'd rather pick civil war over value. JT, we haven't done your veggies yet.
Yeah, let's jump into some EO Wilson. I don't know, do you guys familiar with him much? I don't know if you've ever.
I know the name, but I don't know who that is.
It's really cool. You know, he was born in 1929, so he had a really long run. He died this just like 2 weeks ago or so. And if you're interested in learning more about him, there's this 2015 PBS documentary called Of Ants and Men that was really good. I enjoyed it a lot. But he grew up in Mobile, Alabama. And as a kid, he was like, I think he was 8 years old. He was fishing and a spine of a fish that he caught poked him right in the eye. And he ended up being blind in that eye for the rest of his life. And as a kid, he really liked nature and especially bird watching, actually. But because he only had one eye, like he didn't have stereoscopic vision anymore. Like bird watching doesn't really work as well if you only have one eye. But that led then to him. He had actually like really acute vision in the one remaining eye. Like it became supercharged sort of. And so he had like 20/10 vision and he could see things up close really well. So he ends up looking at the ground more and studying insects. And he really gets into insects as a kid. And I love any kind of story where someone's weakness gets turned into an eventual strength. And I think this is a really cool example of that. His parents also divorced when he was around 7, and he was sent to a military camp apparently because he was kind of a troublemaker. But he figured out that really early on that he wanted to study insects. And he had this wondrous relationship with nature through his entire life. And you could just even, you know, they show him wandering around out in the woods, you know, when he's 90 years old. And like, you just see the joy of a child on his face the whole time. And I don't know, it's really, I find it very inspiring to see people that are so authentic to themselves that way. But anyway, he gets into what's called myrmecology, which is, I guess, the study of ants. And he lists a bunch of cool facts about ants, like, supposedly ants weigh 4 times. If we took all of the ants on Earth and put them into a pile, it'd be 4x the weight of all the land vertebrates. I mean, there are something like 10,000 trillion ants on Earth, which is kind of a number that makes you boggle your mind. Wilson did one by one. But he had this like a curiosity and a real scientific mindset that gave him lots of insights over time that actually, you know, starting off with ants, leading then into other social complex things like the human. And like he could see a lot of the human condition from his study of ants, which I think is interesting. And he observed that we share the desire, like ants, to build complex societies. And so in the 1950s, he was a professor at Harvard for 40 years. And he knew that ants must have some form of communication with each other, but at that time, no one knew what it was. Like, we didn't know how it worked. And he discovered through his research 20 different pheromones that the ants use to communicate. And there's kind of, he like basically went through dissecting ants and crushing an individual organ inside of the ant and then seeing how it reacted, how the ant would react. And there's this cool thing in the documentary where you see him kind of like smearing like an S line. And then all of a sudden you see the ants like start to like root around onto that S line. So it was like the pheromone that the ants used to lay a track to like where, you know, where they found food. So shifting gears a little bit, in Krakatoa, are you guys familiar with this volcanic explosion in 1883? Supposedly killed like 36,000 people. The loudest explosion ever recorded on Earth. They could hear it 5,000 miles away in the Indian Ocean. And it was something like 10,000 times Hiroshima. But anyway, it destroyed all life on the island. But it created this novel experiment where, how do species repopulate a new niche? How do they find dominance in this fresh new area? And scientists at the time realized, you know, this was like a really interesting natural experiment taking place. So a lot of people went there to like go learn and observe and see like, well, how does nature sort of fill this vacuum that was created by Krakatoa? Well, Wilson ends up doing his own kind of mini version of this. He went down into the Florida Keys and he found several islands and they put like basically these tents over them. They're little tiny mangrove little islands. And they fumigated those islands and basically like killed everything was on the island. And then they came back and observed, how did nature fill this niche?
He's a real nature lover, this guy.
All right, yeah, I mean, this. Sometimes you got to crack a few eggs to make an omelet, Toby, come on. But it turns out that there are mathematical equations that are derivable that predict the number of species relative to the size of the island. And this has a like pretty big implications for conservation. So, if you figure, humans developing new areas and we create these little, kind of biological islands sometimes, well, the size of them actually matters a lot to how many species will live in that area and like thrive. And therefore, like how much biodiversity might we expect? And actually, Wilson invented the word biodiversity, by the way. This got me thinking about like in a business context and like, let's say that there's a new area opening up. I don't know, cannabis or electric vehicles or whatever the hell the du jour it is for today. But, could you make the analogy that the profit pools that will eventually be available sort of represent an island? And it might then tell us like how many different businesses could we expect to thrive in that size of an island. And, you think about, let's take it on one end of the extreme, like how many lemonade stands could your neighborhood support? Like that's probably a relatively small profit pool. That would be like a tiny mangrove island that wouldn't support a lot of different, but then I don't know, like what are the five biggest industries on planet Earth? And I happened to look it up. So number five is life and health insurance. Four is e-commerce. Three, commercial real estate. Two, construction, and one, financial services. So maybe perhaps like those are the biggest, sort of islands, if you will, today. But who knows if they'll be that tomorrow. Like these things tend to turn over as well. So a couple other interesting facts, like Wilson estimated that there are 10 million species on Earth, and we've only identified like 2 million of them. So we're at like 20% sort of recognition of the actual total number of species, which is kind of mind-boggling when you think about, like, I don't know, it feels like if you were to just guess at how many species, you'd be like, oh, we probably got like 90% of them at this point, right? So Wilson also...
How would you know what you don't know?
I don't know. I think maybe like a rate of discovery or something. I'm not sure how you would know that.
Sorry, does it cut you off? Keep going.
No, that's okay. So Wilson also has this idea called eusocial. It's eusocial, and it's a concept where here's how you define it. Like it's a group of individuals that live together at least two generations worth. The adults care for the young, and there's a reproductive division of labor. And it's almost as if there's a single super organism that operates on it with its own kind of hive mind. And so we've discovered 19 sort of eusocial lines, and 16 of them are insects. And it happens that humans are the only primate that is a eusocial, that checks the boxes to be eusocial. So you can start to see how Wilson's insights of studying ants for 50 years led him to have these observations about humans later in his career. And it turns out that this eusocial approach is highly productive. And like, so ants and termites and humans, they dominate their niches that they exist in. And so he started to wonder if natural selection could work not just at the gene level, which was the predominant theory, but also kind of at the colony level as a whole. And it became very controversial in social sciences. Richard Dawkins was very against it. You know, he's the author of The Selfish Gene, which was a much more gene-specific version. Stephen Jay Gould, lots of other people. But and Wilson has this kind of funny thing. He said that in reference to ants, Karl Marx was right. Socialism works. It's just that he had the wrong species, which is kind of funny. Wilson also created his own like whole new discipline, which is called sociobiology. And the hypothesis was that behaviors might evolve in the same way that your anatomy would evolve due to evolutionary pressures. And what's crazy is that like people did not want to hear that this was applied to humans at that time. Like psychologists believe that we learned from culture only. There wasn't any nature. It was all nurture. There was no nature. In fact, like there were demonstrations against his classes. People came in and like poured water on him in the middle of his class, picketing his class. Like he was a target in a big way, which is, it's really funny to see because like, when you hear him speak and you know you see the things that he was writing at the time, like it's hard to imagine a more gentle-natured soul than this guy. And meanwhile, he's like the target of all of these radicals. But what ended up happening was that he made it safe for later researchers to explore things about human nature that now we sort of all take for granted. And he proposed this idea of group selection or also called kin selection over. Not just the survival of the fittest individual, but it's also the survival of the fittest group and how they work together. And so like evolution is operating at multiple levels. And he has this really nice quote that is cool. It's like, within groups, selfish individuals win. However, groups of altruistic individuals always beat groups of selfish individuals. So, when you think about like sports, for instance, like that totally makes sense. In a way of like thinking about group selection, like it's really like a ritualization of war. You think about like a college rivalry, Bill, what did Alabama and Auburn games look like in college for you?
People got shot.
Literally?
Yes.
Okay. Wow, that's even more extreme than I would have guessed.
Not all the time, but definitely one of the years somebody got shot in a bar. I think the reason was they said, I think they said that like a shot that Robert Horry hit against the Chris Webber Kings.
Yeah.
I think they said that was a worse defeat than an Auburn Alabama defeat that had just occurred and they got shot.
Wow, that's wild.
It was crazy. People take it seriously down there. That's not the base rate, but there's hatred.
Yeah, no doubt. So
like fuck Alabama.
What do they call that? The Iron Bowl?
Yeah.
Okay. So
I like to call it good versus evil.
So here we're seeing tribalism expressed before our very eyes. It kind of gets you thinking like which companies out there are sort of like creating a group selection, like where are they creating sort of tribes within their customers, within their employees? When the power of humans that use social element takes over, I think it can lead to some very radical outcomes. Maybe Peloton for you, Bill, is a potential idea that fits in with that.
Yeah, I think they got a little bit of a tribe thing going on. Lululemon certainly did.
So one last quote I'll give you from E.O. Wilson that I really liked. And by the way, like he wrote several, like obviously he did a ton of research, but he wrote a lot. I think he won two Pulitzer Prizes for nonfiction. And he won whatever the equivalent is for, it's not the Nobel Prize, but they have a version of that for his field and he won that. But anyway, so here's Wilson. The early stages of creative thought, the ones that count, do not arise from jigsaw puzzles of specialization. The most successful scientist thinks like a poet, wide-ranging, sometimes fantastical, and works like a bookkeeper. And I like the idea that we, like, if you want to be a real scientist about whatever it is that you're working on, maybe getting away from specialization sometimes and thinking a little bit broader and like having some creativity you know, maybe thinking like a poet, I guess, was what he would say, might read to some interesting insights, and then working hard, like diligently, like a bookkeeper about it. So I don't know. It resonated with me for some reason, maybe because I'm a dork, but that's.
Oh, dude, this motherfucker, Chase Jones, you're not a motherfucker, but you just reminded me some asshole, a Bama fan, killed our trees at Toomer's Corner. We had these old trees. This jerk poisoned them and killed them and then called up the radio and bragged about it. Thanks, Chase. You just ruined my day.
There's a podcast about that.
Yeah, really? The guy's a dick.
Or it might have been excuse me. That might have been like a Sports Center 30 for 30 or something like that.
Anyway, something that I was, ESPN it was 30 a 30 for 30. Something I was thinking about, Jake, is like, as you were talking about the maximum amount of like species, there's Spanish moss down here, or like lionfish also do this. Like where I am, people really want to kill lionfish and eat them because they just like destroy everything around them. And Spanish moss is the same way. It just grows like this weed. And, I just feel like the bigger these companies get and the more influence they have over Washington, the more I feel like they're lionfish and Spanish moss, and the less that I feel like the ecosystem can thrive. Like, I really think that big business and big Washington has just gotten too far. Now, I don't know what the answer is other than to reduce the role of government, but
There's this parody account. It's not a parody account. It turns out it's all, she's being truthful, but Elizabeth Warren has this account where she's been going after big meat.
Yeah.
And big, like if you go and look at the things that she's targeted, like they've got no margin. They're not making any money in these businesses.
Yeah, grocery stores. Yeah, she's a moron when it comes to this stuff.
You could go and rank all of the businesses that are listed in the States by like gross profitability. And there are a handful of names at the top that probably really do have an outsized influence and really are gouging consumers and probably not great for everybody. And they don't seem to attract any attention. I don't get it. Like, why does it?
Cough, healthcare.
Well, I will give her this. Like, the chicken industry is very consolidated and it is kind of an old boys club. But when it wasn't, they would lose so much money. Like, it has to be that consolidated for them to make money. So I don't know. I always have problems too when she complains about like capitalists and raising prices. And I'm like, what do you think pension funds are invested in? Like, pension funds need returns. You just want to give those returns away. Good luck fulfilling the obligations.
You know what? Speaking of that, I saw that. An interesting source for this, actually, I was reading Les Schwab's autobiography, which is the guy who was like founded a tire shop. And he had this interesting idea, actually, that he thought that the government should not be able to enter into any kind of contract that has a cost of living adjustment in it. So if we put that constraint on it to where like, sorry, there is no COLA adjustment for your, whatever it is that you're trying to do. Like, boy, do they all of a sudden maybe start minding the monetary side of things a little bit more, right? Cause it's like, well, I'm just going to pass that inflation through in my COLA. I don't care about this.
Do you think they understand? Do you think they understand it?
I think you understand it more when you watch your actual cost of living go up and you're no adjustment on your pension. I think it starts to get real. You'd like the lessons.
Does who understand it?
Well, the people writing those contracts.
Yeah, I think they understand everything. I just don't think they care because their incentives aren't to care. It's to promise a bunch of shit to people. It's pathetic. Politics, what a joke.
We really are ruled by children. When I see some of the stuff that comes up.
It's scummy people want to go into politics, unfortunately, but I mean, it's just so disgusting.
I found the Warren thing really, really weird. Like, why go after meat? Is the thought process like, are people going into the supermarkets and then every time they go to buy meat, the meat's really expensive. So we're going to tap into that growing anger with meat producers.
Is there
just populism in another form?
This isn't even first order thinking. It's zero order thinking.
I shouldn't say scummy people go into politics. I think scummy people are successful in
politics.
That's different. Yeah. Yeah, because you got to have no soul.
I mean, if you talk about the biggest names, the ones that we've been talking about all the time, right? These gigantic companies that are just like, I don't think that Apple's too, I don't think that Apple's too aggressive, but then they might be using slave labor to build some of this stuff. So maybe I'll take that back.
100% they're doing stuff that's like messed up.
Why are we going after Big Meat?
Dude, their phones were made by a company that had to have nets around it so people wouldn't jump to their death. I mean, and just this is
bounce ESG straight back name. In and get keep on making those here. Phones.
Yeah, like how the batteries are mined. Like, who, like, come on, get out of here. It's nonsense. Just no one actually cares. It's the same thing like when Nike was busted for child labor, and people were like, "All right, well, as long as my Nikes are only $80." Like, nobody actually cares about human life as long as they don't have to see it. It's sad.
It's right.
I'm a real downer today. 2022 was supposed to be good. This is what happens when I give up booze. I get
bring on the angry. Civil War. We need catharsis.
Yeah, the odds have gone up. Maybe raise on something.
40% sounds kind of low now.
The Civil War, though, doesn't. The funny thing is, it's not like it's geographic. It's. Oh, I guess it is a little bit now with like the COVID stuff has made Florida's kind of open and everybody, Texas is open, everybody else is closed. But
yeah, where does it break down? Does he have a? Does he have lines battle drawn?
It'd be a weird. It wouldn't be.
I don't know.
Intuitive, right? Like you'd be two houses next door to each other. It'd be fighting each other.
Yeah, I don't know. It's got to be. I bet it would be among economic polarity or something. I don't know.
I'd rather give all my shit around civil and fucking war.
Fight. The good thing we do have going for us is that we've gotten so lazy that we're too lazy to bother going to try to kill each other. We're just gonna like see what's on Netflix instead.
I'll be on Twitter.
I mean, it's going to be the states that have got all the guns that win, right? California's in deep shit.
Florida will be all right.
Florida's going to be okay.
Texas at least where I okay. am.
Do we have time to squeeze in a couple questions before timer's up?
Boss? Yeah, that'd be good. Yeah, that's John McGuire's got print 10 trillion and blame the meat companies when prices go up. Yeah, that's like, increase the amount of dollars that are floating around by 40% over a year or so. And then prices go up 40%. Just like, how did that happen? It's just a mystery to me.
And allow a bunch of consolidation.
Yeah, but they don't make any money, those businesses. Like you need them consolidated so they don't fail.
But I'm forget about the meat company. That's like a moronic statement. I'm just saying like broader antitrust issues. In general. Yeah.
But the things like Google's not really an anti... It's not really an acquirer. I mean, it is an acquirer, but it hasn't rolled itself up to its dominant size.
Yeah, well, that's where I think it gets harder. When you build a dominant machine, or like Amazon, which is using internal cash to develop dominance, that I think is a harder question because I think that should be rewarded. Acquiring dominance, I think, is different. And I don't know why I have that distinction in my head, but yeah. I do.
Yeah, I don't necessarily have a problem with them being that size, but I guess the issue is that they're clearly like exercising some editorial, they have a point of view that they express through YouTube and Twitter has a point of view that it allows expressed. It seems strange to me that there are some experts out in some of these areas that just, you know, you can't, the expert isn't allowed to express their opinion. Twitter knows better. That just seems bizarre to me.
Took 58 minutes, but we got demonetized.
There we go. We did it.
We did it.
2022 is off to a great start. We got that 25-pound Guinness.
Yeah, that Guinness is sweet. Colin Shout Water. Out to you.
I think we owe a heap. Well, it's going to be quite a session. I think Colin's
there are now only few. 8 slots available to listen to. We have reduced it from 10 total listeners to 9. 2 slots go to him.
That's watch us get sued for antitrust for that.
Yes, we're narrowing our own TAM.
If you're saying that Facebook's not harming consumers, you've got FB, Google, consumers are not harmed by those products. I don't know about Facebook, Meta, as it's civil war in the metaverse. Yeah, I think
you
that's
know,
right,
I'll tell you what, I've been chewing up this Lex Fridman pod. He also interviewed the guy that started Instagram. That's a fantastic interview.
That was good.
That I would like highly recommend people listen to. I don't like finding other podcast hosts that I like because they're competition. Fuck that. But I am happy he does it.
There's a little bit of competition out there.
Yeah.
Turns out it's a competitive field.
It turns out any jabroni can just get a microphone and record. And
Samson wants to know which month is the recession this year. I don't know.
Yeah. Speaking of which, sometimes I say stuff and I get DMs that people are like, how could you say that? I think people need to listen to me very carefully. I am an idiot. Okay.
If the Joe Rogan defense.
Yeah. If you think so, guess what? You're probably right. And I welcome the DM. Now, if I get a little bit upset and I shut you down in the DM, I would like it if you don't post my DM publicly without context, because that lacks social awareness. But whatever, do your thing. This is my two cents on that topic.
Oh, yeah. Beefy says Facebook doesn't harm people under antitrust law. Yep, I'm with you. I agree. I think they might be, like the tobacco companies, though, the tobacco CEOs up there having to justify. They had no knowledge. Tobacco, they're like the last people in America to know that tobacco caused lung cancer. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know. I don't have a view one way or the other. It's full time. The hooter's blind. There's no overtime. It's not soccer. Thanks, fellas. We'll see you next week.
Good to see everybody.
Have a good one, folks.